Our presider, Judge Williams, is necessarily absent from the city of Chicago today. She will be participating in the oral argument by telephone, and she will also be participating fully in the deliberations of the court in the case. Judge Williams, are you there?
I am, Judge Ruble. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, we'll begin by hearing the next case on today's docket, which is Robert Zorich et al. Against the United States.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Klein.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. It's John Klein, and I'll speak for all the appellants in the argument today. The way this case has evolved, we really come down to one key question in the harmless error analysis that this court has to undertake. And that question is whether a jury that found guilt based on the improper honest services theory would necessarily have convicted on the properly constituted money or property theory. That's really what it comes down to. And the answer to that question is no, for two reasons. The first reason is that, as the court is aware, pre-Skilling, an honest services charge had to be premised on a private gain. The question is, what was that private gain that the jury in this case relied upon? One possibility is that it relied upon the jobs, which were the property that this court on direct appeal found to be the proper subject of the money or property theory. But that's not the only possibility. The jury could equally have found private gain based on the campaign benefits that the political patrons who supervised Mr. Zorich obtained. There was a lot of testimony, a lot of talk, both in the prosecutor's opening and in closing, about the benefits in the form of free campaign labor that the then mayor's political machine gained from what the prosecutor referred to as the clout machine. The prosecutor even argued in closing that that represented a private benefit. It is entirely possible. We don't know, of course, because we can't interview the jurors, but it's entirely possible that a jury would have based a private gain finding on that private benefit rather than on the jobs that accrued to the people who obtained the jobs. So that's one reason why we cannot conclude that a jury which relied upon the improper honest services theory would necessarily have convicted on the proper money or property theory had that been the only theory in the case. There's a second reason. Let's assume, and of course this is a hypothetical assumption, we have no empirical basis for it. Am I doing something?
You're good.
Okay. Let's assume that the jury based its private gain finding on the jobs. Let's assume that the jury concluded that the private gain in this case was the jobs that accrued to the job seekers who were the political beneficiaries.
And I think that's a – can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
And I think that's a good assumption because the government's position is that there was no independent, standalone, honest services scheme or theory proved by the government, and then all the evidence really related to the fraudulent theft of city jobs. So I want you to address that point.
All right, I will. Let me address preliminarily the government's view that all the evidence related to both theories. I don't necessarily disagree with that. The evidence that was presented in this case may have been relevant to both theories, but that doesn't mean that there was a single unitary theory. In fact, these were two conceptually distinct theories to which the evidence in the case related. And they argued them, I think, at times as conceptually distinct theories, including at the end of their closing when they said that the honest services theory was more important than the money or property theory. But let me go to my second point, as Your Honor requested. If the jury found private gain based on the jobs that accrued to the job seekers, the political workers, that doesn't necessarily mean that the jury would have found that the defendants intended to deprive the city of those jobs or intended to deprive the city of the right to control those jobs. And by that I mean this. The jury could well have found that the job seekers, the people who obtained these jobs, obtained a private gain from those jobs. That seems clear. At the same time, the jury could have concluded that Mr. Sorich and the other appellant in this case didn't intend to deprive the city of anything because those jobs were filled. They were filled by people, not necessarily the people who would have filled them otherwise.
Well, the unqualified people that didn't meet the standards.
Well, there is some anecdotal evidence of unqualified people, but there's also evidence of overwhelmingly qualified people. Now, that gets into the right to control issue on which the jury was not instructed. So I think it would be substituting this court's judgment for the judgment of a properly instructed jury, contrary to McNally, to rely on the right to control theory. But I think that's really what Your Honor is getting to. But what we need to focus on, and I think maybe our opening brief, as I reread it, didn't do this adequately, the question for the jury on a money or property theory is not, was the city deprived of money or property? There can be a money or property theory with no deprivation of money or property. The question is, did the defendants intend to deprive the city of money or property? Was that their intent? And in this case, where the defendants themselves got nothing from this, where they were filling these positions, where the work was getting done, a jury certainly could have concluded that, yes, those job seekers, the political workers who gained the unfair advantage, yes, they obtained a private gain. But no, Mr. Sorich, who was simply doing his job as essentially a functionary in the mayor's Office of Intergovernmental Affairs, he didn't intend to deprive the city of any property. He was just a guy doing his job. That certainly could have been the jury's conclusion. We don't know, of course, because we've never had a trial where just a correct money or property theory was presented. And that, of course, is what we're after here today.
Well, if you just isolate on the honest services, if that were the only charge, what would be what was the consequences of that violation or abuse of honest services?
What was the consequence of having that in the case?
No, the consequences of that charge. If you say the jury could have just focused on the honest services as opposed to the other end of it as far as the hiring and fraudulent hiring. I'm talking about, you say the combination, they could have just focused on honest services.
Right. Charge.
What if you just focused on that, what could be the consequences, what the jury would see?
Well, I think the if I'm understanding your question,
I'm trying to phrase it so that you focus on, okay, they violated this honest services charge, but why? What were the consequences of that violation?
Well, I think the jury's theory quite plausibly could have been that they breached their duty under Shackman, which was tied directly both in the instructions and the indictment to the honest services theory. They breached their duty under Shackman, and the benefit from that, the private gain that they were required to find, was that the mayor's political organization got the benefit of all kinds of free political work. And that was a theory that was clearly presented to the jury.
Why was it free?
Why was it free?
Yeah.
Well, it was free because the workers felt, I assume at least, the workers who were providing the free work felt indebted to the mayor and to his organization.
Yeah, it wasn't free, though. Those workers got paid, and as a consequence, that, if you want to label it that way, they donated that free work, if you want to call it. That was the exchange for the job, apparently. But it had to have some economic consequence there that was a result of the fraud of the getting the jobs.
It may have, Your Honor, but the critical point here is that the jury was never charged on that theory. In other words, if we had a money or property case and the jury was charged on with honest services taken out, and the jury was charged on the theory Your Honor just articulated, and it rendered a verdict, then we would have a finding by a jury as the Sixth Amendment requires. What we're talking about here, and what is sort of the overarching concern from the standpoint of a harmless error review, is that we are talking about hypothesizing a theory, hypothesizing a verdict that may not have occurred. We are substituting our judgment for a verdict rendered by a properly instructed jury, which is what the Sixth Amendment requires.
And see, this is where I have problems because, you know, essentially your argument is that the jury might have viewed the jobs as a gain for the people who gossip, but without a deprivation to the city. I mean, that's essentially what your argument boils down to. But we decided in the direct appeal that the jobs were property for mail fraud purposes and that the indictment led to deprivation of property. So I guess I'm still having trouble with that because it still seems to boil down to me to be just one scheme to reward those positions based on political consideration.
Your Honor, I would have two responses to that. The first is that the argument you've just outlined is part of our argument, although our argument is a little different. The first part of our argument is that the jury didn't necessarily get to the jobs question at all. In finding private gain, they could have stopped at the fact that the mayor's organization got free political work. They never had to go beyond that, and that would have been sufficient for them to return the verdict that they did.
During trial, did the defendants ask for any further instructions on the economic harm theory at all?
I don't believe either side asked for additional instructions.
I see. Thank you.
I would say, Your Honor, I've thought about this question. I think in light of the Black case from the Supreme Court, that that's not something that can be held against the defense in the harmless error analysis. Judge Williams, to return to the second part of your question, this court decided on direct appeal that jobs can constitute property as a legal matter. And we accept that. That's the law of the case. But the question that the jury, a properly instructed jury, would confront in a pure money or property case is a different one. It is whether the defendants intended to deprive the city of money or property. Accepting that jobs are money or property, did the defendants intend to deprive the city of those jobs? A jury could find, yes, they did. A jury could also find, no, they didn't. They filled those jobs.
Was that because they said, as long as they filled it with just anybody, they didn't have an intent to deprive the city?
A jury could reach that conclusion. A jury could have a reasonable doubt about whether the defendants in this case intended to deprive the city. Now, Your Honor may not have a reasonable doubt, but Your Honor is not the jury. And that's the point, the fundamental point that looms over this whole argument, that these appellants, Mr. Sorich and the others, they're entitled under the Sixth Amendment to a jury verdict on that question, not the opinion of – I'm sorry, I've far exceeded my time, but
– Please continue your – just conclude your answer to the judge.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor. They're entitled under Sullivan versus Louisiana, under Brecht versus Abramson, Katiakos versus United States, that whole panoply of Supreme Court harmless error cases. It's clear that just because this court thinks that in a properly conducted trial – a conviction surely would have been returned. That's not enough. They're entitled to have a verdict returned by a properly instructed jury under the Sixth Amendment. And that's what's lacking here.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Mr. Klein, you had many questions from the panel, and therefore I'm going to give you 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Mr. Thompson, I will extend your time by 3 minutes as well.
May it please the Court, Joe Thompson on behalf of the United States. The defendants participated in a single scheme to obtain city money and property in the form of city jobs via misrepresentations by rigging the City of Chicago hiring system, falsifying hiring records. The object of this scheme was city money in the form of city jobs and salaries. The honest services theory in this case did not provide the jury with an alternate path to conviction, separate and apart from this money-property theory. The honest services theory alleged that the defendants breached their duty of loyalty as City of Chicago employees by participating in this scheme to rig city hiring in order to award jobs to political supporters rather than based on merit.
May I invite your attention for a moment, Mr. Thompson, to the instructions that were given at trial? I can accept perhaps your theory as a matter of theory, but when I look at the instructions seem so heavily weighted and detailed on the honest services theory of the case as opposed to the economic loss theory of the case that the jury was certainly told all about honest services, but they were told very little about this how they could find economic loss. I just wonder, as a practical matter, if they focused on that at all or correctly.
Judge, it's not an issue here. And the reason is that the honest services scheme, that listed in the Chapman consent decree, the city policies and procedures put in place in order to effectuate this hiring scheme to make sure that city hiring is done on the basis of merit and not on basis of political campaign work or other political considerations. That was part and parcel of the money property scheme. The misrepresentations that the defendants made that were at the heart of both schemes, the honest services scheme and the money property scheme, were the misrepresentations they made in circumventing that hiring scheme. They falsified city hiring forms, rating forms. They fraudulently filled out certifications stating that hiring was being done on the basis solely of merit, not of political considerations. And in that sense, Judge, even though the honest services instructions were more complicated, they were lengthier, they were part and parcel of, they were some additional instructions certainly than the money property fraud, but it was all aspects and things that the jury was going to have to necessarily consider as part of the money property scheme.
And so what specific instructions do you think specifically spells out the money property scheme and deals with the question that my brother Judge Ripple asked? You know, so that it clearly shows the money property was put in there with all the elements that for the requirements under that kind of theory.
Well, Judge, the
what's your best instructions you would point to? I guess that's better to say.
Judge, the money property instructions required the jury to find a misrepresentation and a property deprivation. The misrepresentation in this case was, of course, the misstatements they made in circumventing the hiring process. It was the hiring scheme that was at the core of this case, both under honest services or a money property theory. The property deprivation, of course, was the theft of these city jobs. They reached into this city hiring process. They circumvented it in order to make sure that these jobs were awarded to political supporters and not on the basis of merit, like the city hiring process was required. If you look, Judge, if you compare those with the honest services elements, the requirement that the government show a breach of the duty of loyalty and the private gain, they're the same thing. The breach of the duty of loyalty was alleged in the indictment, shown by the evidence and in the recording instructions, that the defendants breached their duty of loyalty by circumventing this hiring scheme, the Shackman-related hiring scheme that the city of Chicago had put in place, and making misrepresentations in order to circumvent that, in order to obtain a private gain. And, of course, as was discussed previously, the private gain, as alleged in the indictment and shown at trial, was the city jobs, the theft of the city jobs, and the awarding of those jobs to city workers.
Was there some way that under the honest services elements they could come up with a guilty verdict without any focus on the city jobs?
No. The only scheme alleged here was the scheme to obtain these city jobs and circumvent the hiring system to award these city jobs. That was the only scheme alleged. There's no way that the jury could have found them to have violated, committed fraud on the honest services theory without having found that they participated in this fraud. The defendants have pointed out, have argued that the private gain that required in the honest services theory could have been seen as political advantage. Even if that was the case, and the case, I think everyone agrees, the indictment talks about the scheme as being a systematic effort to provide financial benefits in exchange for campaign work. And it talks about the hiring scheme, the circumventing of the hiring process. The evidence at trial focused overwhelmingly on this hiring process and their efforts to circumvent it. In any event, though, Your Honors, even if the jury was to see the private gain or could have possibly seen the private gain as being the political advantage, that political advantage only existed because of the scheme to award those city jobs. To the extent there were any political advantage, it was because the defendants engaged in a scheme to evade the city hiring process through misrepresentations and misstatements in order to award city jobs on the basis of campaign work. In that case, it's just like the other cases that this court and other courts have held in the wake of both McNally and Skilling, and found the honest services theory was harmless because at its core, any honest services theory was the same as the money property and necessarily resulted in a deprivation of property. Your Honor, one of the points that defendants raised earlier was this question of whether the defendants intended to deprive the city of money or property. That's not an element of money property fraud. The element is that they intended to defraud the city of money and property, and they absolutely did in this case. The defendants' entire scheme, the entire object of their scheme, everything they did was to circumvent the city's hiring system through misrepresentations in order to award property and award jobs and salaries to political supporters. That's at the heart of this case, and that for that reason, it's harmless. There's no way that a rational jury, could have convicted of honest services with the elements of honest services and not found that their scheme awarded those jobs to political supporters.
And then the money, property, fraud instructions you're relying on, could you just review the numbers for me?
I'm sorry, the numbers of the instructions, Judge?
Yes.
Let me open them up here, if you don't mind. I'm sorry, one moment.
No problem.
Well, just, Judge, with respect to the last point I just made about the intent to defraud, the instructions, they aren't numbered in line, but in the appellant's appendix, they're on page 37 of the instructions.
Okay.
That defines the phrase intent to defraud. There are some additional ones I'm still looking for here, Judge.
Perhaps, Mr. Thompson, this is a matter where you'd like to submit a letter to the court after the oral argument indicating the numbers of
absolutely,
the instructions.
Judge, I'd be happy
Judge
to do
Williams,
that.
Would that be satisfactory
that
to
would
you?
That would be happy. I'm just having some difficulty flipping to it using the electronic record. That's what I'm working with, and it was taking me a little long to find it. So
if you could
no
do
problem.
That with the... If you could do that within 10 days with copy to opposing counsel, sir, we would be most appreciative.
Absolutely, Judge. My apologies. Moving on, Judge, one of the issues raised by my opponent here was that it's possible that the jury found that there was no deprivation of property by this scheme. That's just not the case here. Whether or not the workers that the defendants just awarded the jobs to perform those jobs is irrelevant. As this court recently held in the Davali opinion, the city had the opportunity to set the hiring criteria for the city of Chicago, and then not the defendants. The defendants instead acted through misrepresentations and lies to circumvent that hiring process to award those jobs to political supporters. That's a property deprivation. This court has held that both on direct appeal and recently in the Davali opinion. It's clear, you know, these jobs are money. It's not as this court had said on direct appeal, jobs are nothing. It's just like a contract. It's a right and entitlement to money. Whether or not those jobs were not awarded to the people that the city of Chicago wanted to award them to, and that was the deprivation of property. The other issue that they talked about was this right to control theory. Now, to the extent that the defendants, it's not clear whether they're challenging at this point the money property fraud instructions at trial. The defendants, those instructions were proper. They weren't challenged below. To the extent they're challenging them now, that's been procedurally defaulted. But in any event, there's no Sixth Amendment violation here. One, that's the theory that everyone presented at trial, this right to control, whether you call it city jobs or salaries or the right to control, it's all the same concept. And in fact, in denying the pro-trial, the the post-trial motions. The district court called it the right to control theory, and this court did a direct on appeal without objection by the defense. But it's not a Sixth Amendment violation, Judge, because this court has held and the Supreme Court has held that in cases where there's instructional errors, even when the instructional error is a missing element, the courts can still apply harmless error review. And in doing so, they do not violate the defendant's Sixth Amendment right to jury trial. And that's what the court properly did here. It applied the harmless error review to look at what happened at trial to see in whether or not the honest services theory raised grave doubt as to the validity of the money property fraud. And it didn't in this case, like I said, because at the heart of the honest services theory was the money property fraud. Defendants only committed honest services and only violated their duty of loyalty in the fact by engaging in this hiring scheme, by making misrepresentations to circumvent the city of Chicago's hiring system in order to award jobs not on the basis of merit, but to political supporters.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. I'm sorry, Mr. Thompson. Your time has expired. We appreciate your
Thank you,
presentation.
Your Honor.
Mr. Klein.
There's not a Sixth Amendment violation if the jury finding on a services violation necessarily found the money or property violation. And I want to be clear that there are two distinct and alternative paths the jury could have reached to find to convict under the instructions that it received. Alternative number one is the honest services alternative. The jury could have found an honest services violation based on a private gain, which in turn was based upon the campaign benefits that the mayor's political organization received. That is an entirely plausible, possible path to conviction.
You say that's private gain because it's separate from the city?
It is private gain because it doesn't accrue to, as opposed to public gain.
They
yes.
use the word circumvent, but I mean, the benefit, you talk about the money benefit, whatever goes to the politician who's running for something?
Yes.
And they campaign for him as opposed to taking money from the city?
It would be a theory of a benefit to a private person, namely the politician, to get the free campaign labor, as opposed to defrauding or depriving, whichever word you prefer, the city of property, which gets me to the second alternative.
Be a detriment to the city.
A detriment to the city, right. So a jury could have convicted the appellants on that theory, the private gain theory, without ever considering whether jobs were property, whether they intended to deprive the city of property. That alternative by itself could have produced a conviction without any consideration of whether they intended to deprive the city of property.
But how can you benefit a private that private gain without first depriving the city?
You've got to take the job away from
the city in order to benefit the whatever you want to call it, the politician or whatever, make it a private gain.
Well, the government's theory was that the people who got the jobs were people who had done political work, and that it was a sort of an exchange. I guess my point, Your Honor, is that a properly instructed jury could have found guilt without ever considering whether the defendants intended to defraud or deprive the city of anything. That's the critical point. And the issue here is whether the jury necessarily found a money or property violation, not whether a jury likely would have found it, not whether a properly instructed jury almost certainly would convict if it were given the right instructions and we had a new trial. The question is whether the jury in this case, this jury, finding an honest services violation, necessarily found a money or property violation. And the answer is just plainly no. A jury could easily have found an honest services violation without ever considering the question of whether the defendants intended to deprive or defraud the city of anything. That's alternative two, is an intent to a money or property theory based upon an intent to deprive the city of property consisting of jobs. May I say one more, 10 more seconds, Your Honor?
Please.
I simply want to mention briefly the Sanchez case. The idea that it is impossible or that the jury necessarily found a the money or property violation based on the honest services violation is belied by what happened in Sanchez, where a jury was given a special verdict on two counts. It found an honest services violation, and it didn't find money or property on essentially the same instructions and the same facts as we have here. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. The Court would like to thank counsel on both sides for really excellent briefs in this case and for a very fine oral argument today. The case is taken under advisement. The Court has finished the docket of the day, and therefore we will stand in recess until the next scheduled oral argument.